Hello, this is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to Rolling Stone. We start out the month of May, not with the Rolling Stone magazine, but with articles from the 2025 Classic Rock Annual, a collection of articles on some of the most famous rock bands in history. We begin with Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones, and it's the classic rock interview. World War II evacuee, RAF airman, Rolling Stone, hit solo artist, band leader, author, restaurateur, archaeologist, cricketer, even just his time in the greatest rock and roll band in the world is storied. But there's been much, much more to his life than just that. Former Rolling Stone Bill Wyman was born in 1936, a turbulent year of three kings that saw Adolf Hitler's alleged master race significantly whipped by Jesse Owens at the Berlin Olympics. Not being a man widely renowned for his sportsmanship, Germany's sulking Führer duly unleashed a world war that saw 4-year-old Bill Wyman, still known by his birth name of William George Pekes, or less formally Billy, evacuated from a modest, blitzed last three-up, three-down family home in Purge South, east of London, to the relatively leafy enclave of Mansfield Woodhouse, 15 miles north of Nottingham. Relocating to the countryside had a profound effect on young Bill, but after playing truant from school to experience more of it, he was packed off, back to London, from a pregnant mother, reluctantly inattentive, thanks to Bill's two younger siblings, packed off to a truly inspirational grandmother by the name of Florence Jeffrey, who profoundly influenced the man that Bill Wyman became. Coerced into leaving school early by an unimaginative authoritarian father who had found him a job as a bookmaker's clerk, Bill Wyman was then called up for national service with the Royal Air Force. And while serving in Germany, he discovered Skittle, and via a finger-shredding, tea-chest and broom-handled baptism of fire, the bass guitar. Upon returning to civilian life, Bill married in 1959, formed the band The Cliftons in 1961, and while just warming to fatherhood, joined Brian Jones' blues band, the Rolling Stones, in 1962. The Stones, as they came to be known, created quite the stir with their long hair, iconoclastic demeanor, perching for urinating on garage forecourts, and finger-snapping brand of no-holds-barred rhythm and blues. In fact, they conquered the known world. You might have even heard of them. Bill Wyman spent 31 years with the band, which involved 19 studio albums, 42 UK hit singles, and EPs, including 11 number ones, another rather more high-profile and controversial marriage, two divorces, and a best-selling, feather-ruffling autobiography. For 31 years, he stood stock-still and stone-faced at the back of Keith, bemused, observed, biding his time. Excerpted from the band's Jagger Richards songwriting monopoly, Bill Wyman frequented the clubs with Brian Jones during the band's heyday. And while neither excessive drinker nor use of hard drugs found solace in the role of incorrigible swordsman, a role that, while very much expected of the libertine gentleman rock star, as a licentious swinging 60s swung into the permissive uncensored 70s, doesn't translate very well in the 21st century. Upon officially leaving the Rolling Stones in 1993, autodidact Wyman remarried again, formed the Rhythm Kings, a gig-centered combo with a revolving door lineup of A-list musicians, and set about fulfilling all the ambitions they had put on hold while dutifully supplying an ever-reliable bottom end for the greatest rock and roll band in the world. He's since written 14 books, including the million-selling Rolling with the Stones book. There are at least two more books on the way. enjoyed three decades as a West End restaurateur, beat a fearsome charity cricketer on one memorial occasion, taking a hat trick at the Oval, on another, catching out former England captain Brian Clough with one hand while sneaking a fag with the other. A prolific metal detector toting treasure hunter and historian, and much exhibited photographer, not to mention a tireless songwriter and performer. Bill Wyman's long-awaited seventh solo album, Drive My Car, was released in August of 2025, and there is, as he casually confides over an afternoon glass of chilled rosé in his local pub just off Chelsea's King's Road, another one on the way. Just turned 88, Bill Wyman could have spent the last 31 years circumventing the globe, holed up in a never-ending series of five-star gilded cages to perform, somewhat ironically, I Can't Get No Satisfaction, every single night of his professional life to packed stadia as he dutifully studied Keith Richards' ass for cues. But sometimes, for some, the life of a Rolling Stone simply isn't enough. And now the interview with Bill Wyman. Would you define yourself as a happy childhood, Wyman? It was, because although there was tremendous danger all day, every day, sleeping in air raid shelters most nights, going to school with gas masks, everybody had the same problem in World War II. It was just normal when you were a kid. Parents understood it more, so were more scared than you were, but there was such a wonderful community spirit that doesn't exist anymore. Everybody helped everybody else with clothes, food, love, attention. There was a great thing about it, the closeness of the family units and the way everybody shared. It was amazing and really helped because some mornings my mom and dad wouldn't get us out of bed because there wasn't any food. Then they'd scrounge some off the neighbors. A bit of bread was something horrible. We had jam sometimes. But it was a constant struggle. It was a nice childhood, though, because you had friends all around. You had nice times in between the horrors. Question: your grandmother was an important presence during your formative years. What was the most important and enduring life lesson that she taught you? Wyman: everything. Collecting, making scrapbooks, writing a diary. She started me doing that when I was 5 years old. Learning from literature, she read me poems and classics like Treasure Island and Robinson Crusoe. She was extraordinary, taught me my mass, everything, and she gave me love and attention, which my mother wasn't able to do. She had two other children, and she was pregnant in Nottingham. Note, during his mother's pregnancy, five-year-old Bill Wyman returned to London to live with his maternal grandmother. So my mother couldn't, and my dad was in the military, so we didn't get cuddles or told we were loved by our parents. But my grandma hugged me, told me she loved me, and read me bedtime stories. So she was a godsend. She gave me piano lessons, took me to the Royal College of Music, where I passed my first two piano exams. It was through her I really got into music. She got me into the local church choir, which started it all. She did everything. Everything I do now, it's all from her. Question: your national service with the Royal Air Force could not have been an entirely negative experience, as you signed up for an extra year there. Wyman: I only did it because you only had to serve an extra 10 months, and you got twice as much money and leave, and were more accepted by the powers that be, sergeants, corporals, that kind of lot. They'd boss you around if you were a novice kid doing national service, but you were thought of as a regular that you were allowed to dress more casually, let your hair grow longer, set your cap into a different shape, all those little things, and you were respected more. So doing the extra time was okay. Question: and it was at this point, while serving your third year of national service in Germany, that you formed your first skiffle band. Wyman: friends in the next room brought Lonnie Donegan music back from London after they had been on leave, the stuff that he'd done when he was with Chris Barber. So we decided to form a skiffle band. I got an old empty tea chest, a broom handle, some sisal string, and made a tea chest bass, pardon me. The sizzle's so rough, it cut my hands and made them bleed. So I bought a guitar. I formed the band with a guy called Casey Jones, who was up from Liverpool and went on to front Casey Jones and the Engineers. Years later, Eric Clapton told me he had played with him for a short time as well. Anyway, it was very brief. It was only for the last few months I was in camp before leaving to return to civilian life. Question, why the bass guitar? You categorize your role as not to get in the way and not be noticed. Does the fact that you chose this role say a lot about you as a person? Wyman? Well, maybe because I was always shy, a bit of an introvert. When I was in the Stones, I kept out of the way, basically. I didn't want to be out front, leaping about like the rest of them. It wasn't the way I am. I'm too shy to do that, too self-conscious. So I'd stay at the side in the shadows, watch what was going on between the band and the audience, watch the show while I was playing, basically. And why the bass? Purely because when I was forming my band in South London 3 years prior to joining the Rolling Stones, there were three guitarists. And I said, somebody's got to play bass. The lead guitarist said, I'm not. The rhythm guitarist said, I'm not. So I said, I suppose I'm going to have to do it. I didn't have a bass guitar, so I had to make one. And unbeknownst to me at the time, I built the first fretless bass, invented it. So I'm told about 5 years before they came out that I had invented the fretless bass. Question, did your relationship with the dictatorial father and your service in the Royal Air Force lead you to appreciate the freedoms and permissiveness of the 60s more than the rest of the Rolling Stones? Wyman, I was more grown up, I was older, I'd been around, and they looked at me as kind of an uncle. Wyman laughs. Not really, but an older person who learned a bit more than they had, that was always respected. So when we were on our first airplane flight, London to Glasgow or wherever, they'd be terrified, and I had to cool them out. I just said, it's okay, no problem, we're all doing it together. And they were all right after that. But there were moments when I had to suggest other ways of looking at things that they hadn't experienced before. Was also the guy who told all the jokes. Question, when you were in the Stones, you collected memorabilia right from the beginning. Film clips, photos, everything. It's almost like you needed hard evidence to prove that it was actually happening, and it all seemed too good to be true. Wyman, it probably was that, because it started off with me collecting a few things, thinking we were going to be around for maybe a year or two, maybe on television once, have two or three records, and I wanted to leave a few things for my son, who was 8 months old when I joined the Stones, so he would know his dad was in a band once and played a couple of shows. He laughs again. Question, speaking of your relationship with your son, your father instilled very low expectations in you. Didn't he force you to leave school early? Wyman, before my O levels, yeah. Question, when you became a father, were you determined to be different? Oh yeah, I was totally different. But he was one of 10, and his childhood was Dickinsonian. They all lived on half a pigeon's egg each in the morning, and his dad was a tyrant who hit them with his belt. So while my dad was tough, he was nowhere near as tough as his dad was. I thought he was pretty nice. Although we didn't, we three boys slept in one bed. And if we were joking or laughing, my dad would yell up the stairs, go to bed or I'll be up there. Then we'd hear him coming up the stairs and we'd hide under the bed. So he used to get the broom out and hook us with it. I wouldn't say he was a tyrant, but he was very, very firm. His hands were like rocks because he was a bricklayer. So when he hit you, you really felt it. It was like being hit with a plank. Question, at the height of Stones mania, were there moments you feared for your life? Wyman, on a couple of questions. Once, just outside Los Angeles, we left the stadium having played to 5,000 kids. The limo driver chose the wrong exit, and we couldn't get out. Pretty soon the car was covered in kids. They climbed on the boot, the roof, they were banging on the windows, and we had to lay down on the floor with our feet holding the roof up. We couldn't get any air because we were just engulfed. That was quite terrifying. Then the cops came, started swinging their sticks, and cleared a way to the helicopter. Keith had a scarf he used to wear, and on one occasion, some of the girls got a hold of one end of it and some of the other, and then they started to pull and wouldn't let go. Nearly strangled Keith. So you had those moments, all your clothes ripped and big chunks of hair pulled out. But it wasn't frightening, terrifying, or really dangerous. You just had to laugh it off in the end. Question, during the 60s, when people weren't screaming at you, could the life of a touring Rolling Stone get monotonous? Because you all sought escape routes, drink, drugs, sex. From the outside, it looked like you could have anything you wanted except actual satisfaction. Wyman, it was pretty dismal because you never really saw anywhere. You flew into a town, you'd be straight into limousines at the airport, and then straight into the underground car park of the hotel. You then had to wait while they cleared all the girls out of the corridors and the room sometimes before you could go up to your room. And then you were stuck in your room until you went to do the show. You did the show, went straight back to your hotel room where you stayed until you got up in the morning and left for the airport to go to the next town. There were always girls everywhere, in the elevators, on all the floors, trying to find which rooms you were in. Sometimes they climbed the bloody drain pipes and fire escapes to get into your room. It was all kind of fun, particularly for Brian Jones. He thought it was hilarious. You could see him laughing in all the pictures. Question, the Rolling Stones were originally Brian's band, yet his role was gradually eroded until he seemed to lose control of his entire life. Stone's manager from 63 to 67, Andrew Oldham, decided to get Mick and Keith to start writing songs because he realized that Mick, being the frontman, would probably be the most famous later on. Brian originally got more fan mail than the rest of us. All the girls went for Brian. But he was pushed aside. Then Andrew stopped me, Brian and Charlie doing interviews, which also elevated Mick and Keith's profile. Obviously, it was ultimately beneficial for Mick and Keith to take on the music, but Brian, who I shared a room with at the time, was always a bit sad, upset that we weren't doing the kind of music he really liked, because we started out doing real blues, and he was a blues purist. Brian had kind of lost the band, and it didn't feel like he was part of it sometimes, which was very sad. Mick and Keith shared a room. Our manager, Andrew Oldham, and Charlie, and me and Brian. That's the way we always did it. It was me and Brian that went out to clubs, played with local musicians, picked up girls, and had more fun than the others. We used to just stay in the hotel, basically. Mick and Keith used to just to be writing. They'd come out occasionally, but me and Brian were always out and about. Question, did your camaraderie with Brian have an effect on your relationship with Mick and Keith? No, I wasn't just friends with Brian. I was very close with Charlie because we were the rhythm section and got on very well. We were both similar, early married, had a child, went home after London concerts to join our family while the others were out partying at the Ad Lib with all the other celebrities. I had a very close affinity with Charlie. I joined the band on the 8th of December, 1962. Because Tony Chapman, the drummer from my band in South London, who had been playing with the Stones for a few months, introduced me. Then they fired him and got Charlie in on the 9th of January, 1963. But on the road, I was with Brian mostly. There was no malice. They just got fed up with his drug taking. None of the rest of us took drugs. Well, Keith. They did a bit, but there's no heavy stuff for years. I never had any, nor did Charlie. We were always completely clean. We had responsibilities, so we behaved ourselves. Question, what's Bill Wyman's finest performance on a Rolling Stones record recording? Wyman, I'm proud of a lot because I did things on the bass that a bass player wouldn't normally do. Instead of playing a straightforward 12 bar, I'd lean away, find other notes, do little runs on the top strings, and slide. Bass players never did slides until I started. I mean, they did on double basses, but I did it right from the beginning because I had a fretless bass, so it was very smooth. I always got flat wound strings and had guitars where I could do those slides on stuff like I'm a King Bee. I was helped by a great friend who was a bass player with Booker T and the MGs, Donald Druck Dunn. I learned so much from him, Donald, to play simply, right there with the drums in the groove, timing perfect, but really simple. Leave space, leave air, because it's very important to do that, not fill it all up. That's what a lot of people want you to do. You have bass players that sound like lead guitarists. Question: you mentioned in passing in Oliver Murray's 2019 documentary, The Quiet One, that Altamont nearly led to the death of the Stones. Wyman, it was so dangerous that day, I don't even like talking about it, to tell the truth. It was like a really bad nightmare that didn't want to go away. Me and Mick Taylor were right in front of where the guy got stabbed. The others were over on the other side, but we were on that side of the stage where it happened, so that was pretty horrible. He just ran, and the guys chasing him stabbed him 3 times with his big knife. Then when we had to leave, there's only one helicopter left, and the helicopter pilot came on stage while we were playing and said, "If you don't finish now, I'm going. I've had enough." And we were the last ones, so we had to stop, finish the song, rush off the stage, and then with security and some of the staff and crew, we all climbed into this helicopter, which held 8 people, 20 of us climbing on top of each other and trying to take off. When it lifted, it went sideways until it could finally get some height. Well, we'll wrap up this interview with Bill Wyman with a final question. Are you glad you left the Rolling Stones when you did? Wyman: well, I should have done it a lot earlier. In the 80s, I hung on for a 3-tour ending across 1989 and 90, 3 legs of the Steel Wheels Urban Jungle Tour. And after 7 years of nothing, I ended up with a bank overdraft of £200,000 because we weren't really earning anything. Mick and Keith were totally wealthy, so they weren't bothered, but me, Charlie, and Ronnie were scraping by. Ronnie started to do art to feed his family. Anyway, I only started playing with them again in the hope it would only be for a couple of years because I had all these other things I wanted to do. I wanted to do archaeology, write books, do photography. I wanted to play charity cricket. I wanted to do all these other things. And 30 years on, I'm still wanting to do them to tell the truth. So I was so happy to leave in the end, which they obviously didn't like and refused to accept. They said, "You have not left." And when they were doing the plan for the coming year, I said, "Well, there's no point me discussing it because I'm leaving." And they went, "You're not leaving." I said, "I am leaving," and I left. And they wouldn't believe me. 2 years went by, and they were putting the band together again to make a new record in 1994. And they said, "Are you still in the band?" I said, "I left 2 years ago." Mick and Charlie tried to talk me out of it, bless them, but I didn't want to. I just dropped everything, cleared the air, gave up a career, a terrible marriage, got married again, and formed the Rhythm Kings with George Fame and Gary Brooker just for fun. And next up in our deep dive into rock and roll is Alice Cooper. Revenge is sweet. When Alice Cooper's album Billion Dollar Babies hit number one in the UK and US in 1973, instead of solidifying the band, they unraveled. It would be 50 years until the original group recorded another. Eccentric performances and preternaturally talented showmen, the Alice Cooper band were as much art provocateurs as musicians, one of the few glam acts that managed to slither into the mainstream. It's Scrooge barely more than a blink of a mascara's eye that saw Vince Fulner shortly be rechristened Alex Cooper, Dennis Dunaway, Neil Smith, Glenn Buxton, and Michael Bruce go from being the most hated band in Los Angeles with a superpower to clear a venue in a single song to become one of the biggest bands in the world. After the release of the 6th album, Million Dollar Babies, in 1973, they were on top of rock's mighty slag heap with the album at number one in the UK and US and three top singles in the UK in that year. Looking back over five decades, with something of a jaundiced eye at some of the lesser metal rock and hair bands that have fallen by the wayside, it's impossible to overemphasize the effects that the Alice Cooper Band had on music, performance, attitude, social norms or abnorms, and the outcast teenage audience at large. This was a band that changed the landscape of art, respectability, and stage wear with their transgressive songs, morality plays gone amok, onstage executions, boa constrictors, and twisted humor. When we came on the scene, the world was looking for a villain, Alice Cooper said sanguinely at that time, and we were it. In fact, it's often been said that this is the one band that drove a stake through the heart of the peace and love generation that had preceded them. And they were about to do the same in South America. The first rock group ever to perform in Brazil, a Catholic and notoriously conservative country more accustomed to the samba, rock, rural, and Antonio Jobim records. The Coopers had come here 2 weeks before, Easter in 1974, at the tail end of what they were still calling their Billion Dollar Babies tour. The Muscle of Love album was released in November 1973. They were the number one rock group in the world, according to a British poll, outselling David Bowie, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Elton John, and The Who that year. Although a secret shame in South America was that they were runners-up to the Rolling Stones, not on the basis of sales, because Mick Jagger was then married to a Nicaraguan woman. They landed in Brazil like conquerors on March 28, 1974. Not just a rock band, they were a menacing phenomenon, part circus, part horror movie, part phantasm, and all swagger, teenage rebellion ritual, aggressive androgyny, and psychic danger. In their satin stovepipe pants, messy black eyeliner, and prodigious butt-skimming hair, the Alice Cooper Group didn't just arrive, they invaded. Their visit to the Southern Hemisphere was Beatlemania, plugged into a different socket, one where the Beatles had been raised on acid, beer, B-movies, and Detroit garage rock. From the moment they arrived, they were flanked by bodyguards. Alice had seven of his own, and corralled into jeeps equipped with mounted 50-caliber machine guns. But the security did not deter the fans. Thousands of them kept up the 24-hour vigils outside the group's hotel, trying to sneak into their rooms dressed as waiters, chambermaids, and hookers. Many succeeded. When group members emerged, despite the guards and guns, they were manhandled, pushed and pursued, like a scene out of a Hard Day's Nightmare. The first day, fans ripped the sleeve of Cooper's jacket right off his shoulders and grabbed a handful of the band members' hair as souvenirs. The shows were even more frenetic and frightening than their arrival. Playing five dates over 7 days, they set a record that it endures to this day when they performed at the Anhembi Exhibition Hall in São Paulo in front of 158,000 unruly attendees. Undulating waves of aroused punters crashed through the stage like an out-of-control soccer melee. They looked like a field of wheat, guitarist Glenn Buxton drawled, but a field of hair. Yeah, those people look like a wheat field flowing back and forth, guitarist Michael Bruce echoed. But I knew that if they flowed the wrong way, something bad would happen. Something did. When the band's equipment was turned on, the crowd freaked out and began to stream forward. By the third song, it looked like the ocean, because there were 150,000-something people in this humongous building, remembered Bruce. There weren't any seats, and everybody was standing up. So as they were pushing closer to the stage, you got a wave effect happening. The wave kept crashing against the stage, and now you had bodies building up at the bottom. About the third song, the first person that climbed up on the bodies below them made it up on the stage, and it was getting worse. I kept wondering what's happening to the people on the bottom of this body bath. Then the next thing I saw was this well-dressed man in an Adidas top. He walked out on stage, reached inside his jacket, and pulled out a gun and goes, makes gun noises, pop, pop, pop. I'm thinking, okay, I'm dead. We hunkered down, and everybody out of the audience went down to the floor. They ushered us off the stage, and we're thinking, what is fucking going on here? We're all asking questions, but no one answered. Then about 15 to 20 minutes, they brought us back on the stage. Everybody was sitting down now. The Sao Paulo show and the four after it were triumphs. The five band members playing as if it were the end of the world. Fans were half convinced that the devil himself had booked the amphitheater. More than half were convinced that Alice was the devil himself. They called him the demon with a snake. A newspaper ran a full-page photo of him on the front page with a single word beneath him, Macumbo, which means voodoo. But no one in the crowd that night had a clue that they were witnessing a funeral. On paper, the band were on top of the world. But beneath the glitter and the guillotines and even the lifelong friendships, something vital had unraveled. When they left the stage at Concerto do Mukunzingu in Rio de Janeiro on April 6th, to the strains of Schools Out, they sat closer, no one suspected, not even the band, that when they walked off the stage after that set, they were never to return. Why didn't they? Depends on who you ask. It wasn't until four decades later that their manager, Shep Gordon, in his 2016 memoir, They Call Me Supermensch, broke the code of silence surrounding the days leading up to the breakup of the most beloved and at one time, biggest group in the world. Shep Gordon wrote, after the years of hard work and starving, the band was seemingly poised to take over the world. Instead, they were slowly falling apart. They scattered themselves around the Gagliese mansion, where they were recording billion-dollar babies in Connecticut, and lived separate lives. Alice spent much of his time holed up in the master bedroom, drinking Bud and watching TV, while the rest of them complained more about falling into his shadow. When we brought in a mobile unit to lay down the basic tracks for billion-dollar babies, producer Bob Ezrin also decided to bring in a session guitarist to play Glenn's parts. I understood why it upset the rest of the guys that Alice had become the star. They had all gotten into rock because they wanted to be stars, but they all couldn't be the star. We'd agreed that had to be Alice. We were on track to our goal of becoming millionaires. I couldn't let their bruised egos derail us. Because of that, the blame is often laid at Alice Cooper's platform boots. But the answers to the mystery isn't as simple as that. I didn't feel that something was changing after Brazil, that it signaled some kind of ending. Not at all, Alice Cooper says from a stop on his current tour with Judas Priest. Alice was pretty deep into the bottle back then, reflected bassist Dennis Dunaway, so he wasn't always available as he was in the earlier days. On the Billion Dollar Babies tour, Alice would be in his room with the bodyguards, and they would have their own party going, and they didn't want to be there because it would be competition for them. And Alice would just be sitting there watching TV with a whole room full of people watching Alice watch TV. If Alice said, can somebody get me a beer, 100 people would scramble. But for me, no, the last shows in Brazil did not signify any kind of an end. I was always the crusader for forging on. I was deeply convinced that Alice was my best friend, which he still is, and Shep Gordon was my best friend, and I'm the one that kept the pie-in-the-sky naivety going. But regardless, it was certainly something, because after those five Brazil shows, the band never played again. Was it just a case of a group at its peak crumbling under the weight of their success? They were more popular than they'd ever imagined, more famous than they ever dreamed, but also more fractured. People forget how dysfunctional we were, Alice says simply today, especially when we were the hottest band in the world. We were voted number one band in the world. I think the band believed that we always came from, we got to prove ourselves. Nobody ever expected us to even make a second album, he adds. I think we got cocky. That wasn't who we were. I don't think the band remembers that. Oh, but they do. Did I know we were the biggest band in the world? Of course we did, says drummer Neil Smith. We had worked very hard to achieve what we'd achieved at the time, and we were all enjoying it. People always ask if I could have anybody or anything. And I did, by the way. Was I an asshole about it? Yeah, but I was a happy asshole. We believed from the very beginning that we were going to be a big band, Dunaway remembers. We couldn't believe it that every time we put out an album, the world didn't see it the way we did. You can look at Neil and think he's got this rock star personality going. He had that way back when he was playing clubs in Phoenix, Arizona. So it wasn't like all of a sudden we're just a lowly band and overnight we're big stars. We already thought we were stars. Difference was that the world finally believed us. But Bruce never seemed to feel that way. A Tyler's songwriter, a little bit of an outsider in the group, a former football player, he went to a different high school in Phoenix than Dunaway, Cooper, and Buncton. He looks at the past through a different lens than his compatriots. What was it like to be that famous? He asked rhetorically. I'm not sure I even know. I don't think we expected Billion Dollar Babies to go to number one. First of all, we were gradually coming up in the trades, each album building on the next, and we thought it was going to keep doing that. It was like the first time we heard 18 on the radio. It was unexpected. We pulled the car over, pinched ourselves, and asked, is this really happening? Even after Billion Dollar Babies, I didn't think it would go on forever because I felt there was a lot of work still to do. It was hard to keep it together, and it's probably lucky it lasted as long as it did. Some say the breakup's main cause was exhaustion. The slow poison of touring, recording, and promotion without a break finally corroding the band's center. They've been running on adrenaline and ambition for the past 7 years, releasing 7 albums during that time. Others whisper that it was fame itself that killed them, that once they became the monster they had created, they couldn't outrun it, or that Alex was getting all the attention. Had Buxton's increasing drug use and withdrawal from the band destroyed the band's delicate equilibrium? Or was it Buxton's resentment at feeling micromanaged by Bob Ezrin's discipline, professionalism? Or was it the principal songwriter Bruce feeling slighted that his songs were deemed not Cooperin enough for their records, causing many to be shelved? Or that Alice and his then-girlfriend had moved out of the Glazy Mansion for their own apartment in New York, separating from his pals for the first time since they left Phoenix in 1967. So much more was afoot besides feeling that their pal Vince was getting all the attention. As with any breakup, you can never put the blame on just one single source, and the transmigration of the Alice Cooper band into Alice Cooper the man was no different. Separately, none of the causes seemed ruinous enough to derail this groundbreaking, chart and crowd-conquering band, but together they make a compelling case for what came next. There were just so many things that added up to that breakup, unconscious things, psychological things, and it really was that we gave it everything we had for 7 years, and we were tired, as Alice Cooper sums up. The thing that would bother me was that we were getting on each other's nerves for the first time, he says. We didn't know how to stop it, and the only way we could stop was sort of a divorce for a while or a separation. So they took a break. Bruce made plans to turn his collection of songs that didn't fit the group into a solo album, which in turn prompted Neil Smith to announce his plans to record his own solo album. From the beginning, Dunaway was staunchly against the hiatus, writing in his memoir, Snakes, Guillotines, Electric Chairs, stating, I had some songs too, but they were all intended for the Alice Cooper group. If loyalty is a weakness, then I'm a wet noodle. Still, I fought tooth and nail against the idea of solo projects. Buxton didn't seem to care one way or the other, and Cooper didn't say a word about his plans, which at the time no one thought was odd. The five friends made a pact to return in a year's time to record what was to be the group's 8th album, come what may. We did everything by vote. No one's vote had more power than anyone else's, Dunaway explains. Whatever the majority wanted to do, then we would go with that. When it came to Michael deciding he needed to record an album where he didn't have to submit it to a band that was going to change it, I Love You to I Want to Kick a Puppy, I was totally against it. In fact, I was absolutely against taking any kind of break. I said, we just made it to number one. Are you kidding? The argument that won me over was that Alice and Glenn were in such bad shape that we needed to get them out of the situation so they can get a chance to dry out. So we decided that we were going to take time off, Michael would record his album, and then the band would get back together. And after the break, we would do a bigger album than ever and we'll be more pop than ever because of the break. That was what we thought was going to happen in the time off. Neil did his Platinum God album. I helped him with it, but that was just so Neil, and I couldn't keep in shape for what they wouldn't lose our chops. For me, it was more than keeping my chops up, Smith said. After we got back from South America, Michael wanted to do a solo album. We all agreed. So you can put blame on anybody that you want to, but we all agreed to take the year off. And in that year, we all agreed we could do a solo album. Glenn didn't want to, and Dennis didn't, but I did. And I recorded Platinum God, and Dennis helped me on it. Michael did his album in my own way. And then in our surprise, Alice did an album, Welcome to My Nightmare. We weren't expecting that. I'm not sure why not. We'll wrap up Alice Cooper at this point. You're tuned into Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you're listening to Rolling Stone. We next turn to another interview of a rock artist in the 2025 Classic Rock Annual, and that's the artist Glenn Hughes. With Trapeze, Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, Black Country Communion, solo projects and more, the bassist and vocalist has spent more than 50 years in rock. Addiction nearly derailed Glenn Hughes' roller coaster career, but Glenn pulled himself back from the brink and is still going strong. A life, not half. 30 seconds into our conversation, Glenn Hughes started fiddling with his earbuds. Give me a second, Glenn says, with a California smile, a healthy tan offsetting his immaculate white teeth. I'm still deaf from working with John Lord. If battered eardrums is the only residual damage that Carnuff Staffordshire-born Hughes has to show from more than 55 years in rock and roll, he's got off lightly. The bassist and singer was one of hard rock's thrusting young bucks through the 1970s, making a trio of great, if underrated, albums with his original band Trapeze, then another three albums as part of Deep Purple's MK3 and 4 lineups. The latter trilogy, 1974's Burn and Stormbringer, and 1975's Come Taste the Band, rejuvenated Purple after the departure of vocalist Ian Gillan and bassist Roger Glover. Inspired by soul and R&B, Glenn Hughes brought a funk edge to a band not previously renowned for their funkiness, not to mention powerhouse vocals that dovetailed perfectly with fellow newbie singer David Coverdale. Not everyone was happy, not the least Purple guitarist Ritchie Blackmore, who quit in disgust at the direction the band were taking. Hotshot American guitarist Tommy Bolin replaced him for the album Come Taste the Band. After Purple fell apart in 1976, Glenn Hughes embarked on a solo career. His debut album, 1977's Play Me Out, was his answer to David Bowie's Young Americans. A white English rock guy channeling the black American music he loved. But any promise he had was holed between the waterline by a heavy drug addiction. From the late 1970s to the early 1990s, Glenn Hughes wasn't so much a musician with a drug problem as a drug addict with a music problem. I didn't plan on becoming a drug addict when I was 5 years old, he says. He's been studying Buddhism for the past 15 years and says everything he went through back then was preordained. I believe it was meant to happen in my storyline in this particular lifetime. Fate or not, he finally cleaned up once and for all in 1997. Since then, he's released a string of great solo albums, some of them rocky, some of them funky, some of them both. He's also a member of a handful of bands, including the short-lived California Breed, alongside future Aussie Rolling Stones producer Andrew Watt, and more notably, Black Country Communion, the blues rock supergroup he formed with the guitarist Joe Bonassa, drummer Basin Bonham, and keyboard player Derek Sherinian. He's actually on tour with the latter when we speak, although he's here to talk about his upcoming solo album, Chosen. It's his first since 2015's Resonate, and that's not all. This may be the last Glenn Hughes solo album, Glenn says. It was suggested that I needed to do one for the label. I owed them an album, so I thought, okay, if that's the way it's going to be, and I wrap my head around it. Solo albums for me are very personal. I like to make records when I have something to say. I don't think about genres anymore. I just think, how's this going to sit with me? Chosen sounds like anything but a contractual obligation. It's as powerful and soulful as Resonate or the 2005's acclaimed Soul Mover, the latter his late career tipping point. But if it does prove to be his solo swung song, it will cap a career that's taken him to the highest highs and the lowest lows. And now the interview. Question, your first instrument was a trombone. This could have been a very different conversation. Hughes, when I was 12 years old, the principal of my school was looking to put an orchestra together, and somehow they chose me to play the trombone. So I started to learn how to play trombone and read music. It wasn't what I wanted to do, but playing the trombone led to playing the piano, and then that led to playing the guitar. Question, why did you end up gravitating to bass? Hughes, well, at 13, I was a guitarist. There was a kid 3 or 4 years older than me named Mel Galley, who also played guitar. I used to see him playing gigs in Cornock, and he became my idol. I loved watching him play. I used to mimic everything he did. I tried to look like him, and he knew I was this budding little guitar player. So Mel joined a band called Finders Keepers, and about a year later, their bass player left. And Mel said, I know a young kid from my hometown. Maybe he could switch from guitar to bass. With 24 hours, I was learning how to play bass simply so I could play in a band with Mel. Question, you were already a huge fan of Black American music at that point. What was it about that resonated with you? Hughes, I didn't choose it. It was meant to happen. When I was 15, my girlfriend's brother ran a discotheque in Walsall on the weekends. I'd go with them and fetch him coffees and Cokes. I ended up hearing all this great music. Motown, Stevie Wonder, Al Green, Marvin Gaye. All this music was slowly but surely etched into who I was. Most of my school friends were listening to the Beatles and the Stones and Dylan. But for me, it was R&B. It was about the groove of James Brown, and the melodic vocals of someone like Stevie Wonder. Groove and melody is who I am. Question, you joined Trapeze when you were 18. What was it like in those early days? Hughes, it was incredible. The other guys were all older than me. Mel Galley was the next youngest, and he was 3 years older. When I joined, there were 5 people in the band. I was a bass player that occasionally sang a few lines. But Mel and David Holland, drummer, had a meeting with management behind my back saying, Glenn's singing great. What if we could build a thing around him? And they called me into the office and said, how would you feel about fronting the band? I go, what? I had no idea this was happening, by the way. I was just finding my voice back then. And I felt that we had to let the original vocalist, Johnny Jones, go. I still love that 5-piece lineup. Trapeze is still the most important music I ever made. Question, really, why? Hughes, because of my dear love for Mel and Dave and working with those two people so closely in Cornock all those years ago. We were so in tune with each other as a trio, musically. Mel was getting into groove music along with me. Dave Holland was a really great drummer. Oh my God, that band was everything to me. Question, you were asked to join ELO at one point, what would that have sounded like? Hughes, this was around 1971. I was hanging out with ELO's co-founder, Roy Wood, when his previous band, The Move, were breaking up. Roy was one of my close friends, and he obviously thought it might be something that could work. ELO's notorious manager, Don Arden, came to me and said, hey, you want to take a meeting with me? He sat me in the back of his Rolls Royce, smoking a cigar, and asked if I wanted to join ELO. I was too frightened to say no, so I said meekly, of course. I really didn't want to do it. My mom called Roy Wood up a week later and said, Roy, he's having a meltdown. He doesn't want to join. My mom had to tell Roy Wood that I couldn't join ELO. Question, what would ELO with Glenn Hughes have sounded like? Hughes, you had Roy and Jeff Lynne, two insanely great writers and leaders of the band, and they wanted me to be a singer and bassist. What would that have been like? I'm an R&B guy. I'm not sure it would have worked. Question, instead you stayed with Trapeze. Should that band be better known than they are? Hughes, we are one song away from cracking it. Medusa in 1970 was heavy, but we came with 1972's You Are the Music, We're Just the Band, Coast to Coast, Ray Back to the Bone, What is a Woman's Role, You Are the Music, all these fantastic groovy crossover R&B songs. Oh my God, we were so close, I should never have left. Question, but you did. You replaced Ian Gillan in Deep Purple in 1973. Hughes, they'd been watching me for a year. They'd seen me with Trapeze at the Marquee in London, at the Whiskey A Go Go in Los Angeles, of all places. I was in Baltimore, Maryland with Trapeze the same week Purple were in New York when they were playing a show. John Lord flew me in, so I had a feeling something was going to happen. I watched the show from the side of the stage, and the next day I was in a meeting with John, Ian Price, Richie, and their managers and attorney. And they said, would you like, and I thought they were going to ask me to be lead singer, but they said, we would like you to play bass guitar because we're going to ask Paul Rogers to sing. I thought, really? You just want me to play bass? So I basically said no, but I was very respectful. I said, it's not what I really want to do. Question, why not? Hughes, Trapeze were established and I was a lead singer. I didn't want to do something that I didn't think was appropriate. Deep Purple's music was very classic, very square, white boy rock. I wasn't that way. I thought, is this really what I want? I wasn't interested in it to make money, and I just didn't know if I'd be happy in that scenario. I was just going to come in and sing oohs and ahs. Question, why did you change your mind? Answer, it was the idea of singing with Paul Rogers. I thought, I have this voice. There's a possibility we can explore this. I think it would have been great, the two of us, but obviously it didn't happen. And after I joined, David Coverdale came in. And by the way, David and I worked brilliantly together. While we were writing the Burn album in Clearwell Castle, we had two microphones set up. David and I would look at each other and go politely, after you. No, after you, I insist. There was a lot of respect there, but I knew I had the voice. Question? Well, what was Richie Blackmore really like? When I joined the band in 1973, Richie took me to Hamburg. We sat on a bar, still in a bar, for 3 or 4 days. We had the most amazing time. He told me so much about himself. He had so much aspiration for what I was bringing into the band. He was giving me so much encouragement. One-on-one with Blackmore, it was fantastic. He laughs. We only had one-on-one moment, and that was it. That aside, what was the most Richie Blackmore thing that you saw Richie Blackmore do? Hughes? When we were going down really well at shows, Richie would refuse to do an encore. He would have to be forced to go back on stage, and even then he would play behind his equipment. It was so ridiculous, you couldn't make him do anything. Question, well, what did you learn from Richie Blackmore? Hughes, what I didn't learn was the stuff that I didn't agree with. He was an isolator. He had his own dressing room, his own car. It wasn't a band. It was us, and it was Richie. That's been his thing forever. It was uncomfortable for me. I missed the family aspect of all of us together. It was a strange situation. Question, can you settle something for Deep Purple fans? Which Purple album is the best? Burn, Stormbringer, or Come Taste the Band? Use Stormbringer. Question, really? Use, yeah, we knew Richie was leaving the band. He brought in Stormbringer and Soldier of Fortune and a couple of others, but John, David, and myself were left to write the album. Nobody said, you can't be funky. And if you leave me in a room with John Lord and David Coverdale, that's what you're gonna get. I was writing songs like, You Can't Do It Right with the One You Love, and Hold On and Love Don't Mean a Thing. A lot of Purple fans didn't like the album because it was too damn funky. But if you give me the opportunity, that's what happens. Question, have you still got those fantastic furry boots that you had back then? Use, I don't. I moved house so many times since then, and my dad gave a lot of stuff away. Fans would come knocking on his door and car knock, and he'd give me my stuff. Question, drugs entered the picture for you during your time in Purple. How did you step onto that path? Use, well, when anyone has success, there'll be people around offering them stuff, jewelry, watches, girls, drugs. When I joined Purple, I was given all kinds of drugs, pills, things like that. I would flush them down the toilet or just leave them in my pocket and not do anything with them. After about 6 months in Purple, I started to go, what is this stuff about cocaine? One night I found something in my pocket. I was alone in my room and I sniffed some of it and I went, oh, this is fun. This is making me happy. Slowly but surely, I started becoming addicted. I thought, I'm young. This isn't everybody snorting cocaine off of strippers' burns. Part of it for me was that maybe I wasn't that happy. It was glamorous in Deep Purple. Everything I ever wanted was there, yes, but I just wasn't as happy as I should have been. With respect to David, I was a lead singer when I joined the band, and now I was basically known as a second singer. I loved singing with David. We sang brilliantly together. We had a great friendship and camaraderie. But all along I was thinking, I shouldn't have joined the band because I really need to be singing. Question, Deep Purple ended in 1976. Were you relieved? Use, I was relieved in a way. I was desperately in trouble, really not great. It gave me the opportunity to slow down and address how I was going to continue to live my life. Question, you and David Bowie had come into each other's orbit by then. What was that period like? Huge. David was living at my house in LA in March 1975. He was in his thin white Duke era. We were jamming, writing stuff, just the two of us. Even then, David said, you should be thinking about what your next move is. We talked about doing an album together. David was in his whole soul R&B thing back then, which was my world completely. He recorded Young Americans, which was fantastic, so I decided I was going to make an album in that R&B mold. I started writing, which was Hughes' 1977 debut solo album called Play Me Out, with David Bowie in mind to do it with me. Unfortunately, he wasn't available to produce it. Question, did you ever record anything with him? Use, no, I didn't. David invited me to sing on Young Americans, but Blackmore advised me not to do it. He was quite angry that I even suggested it, so it didn't happen. Well, we'll wrap up the interview of Glenn Hughes at that point. We'll wrap up this edition of Rolling Stone. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'll be back with you next week for the next edition of Rolling Stone. Thank you for listening.